name's Ali, and this is the Rus Files Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I'm joined by a guest, and today my guest is Joel. Hi, Joel.
Hello. My name is Joel.
My name is Ali.
That's good.
Yeah, we're just referencing one of Joel's podcasts. As he is on more than one, but I'm kind of doing your job for you here. Thanks, by the way, for coming on the show. So, Joel.
Oh, thank you for having me. Absolutely.
Tell me a bit more about yourself.
So I'm a California native who is obsessed with movies and. I'm not a prolific podcaster. I do have two podcasts going on. I've got High and Low, which I do with Spencer, previous guest Spencer. And that's all about Japanese movies with a focus on Kurosawa's library. And then I also have another podcast called Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, where me and my co-hosts Sarah and Aaron watch science fiction and fantasy movies.
I was going to say one of the films that you covered on there was the very first one I covered on here, i.e. Stalker by Tarkovsky. But that's possibly a sore subject.
You just, why would you choose that to step right out of the gate on? Because it's not exactly easy watching, you know, here.
That was purely down to the fact that Lynn and I were just chatting and we were kind of thinking, you know, we want to watch this film, and I'd also kind of like to do a podcast about Russian films. So Lynn wanted to watch that one, and I was kind of like, why not? I guess let's watch that one. So we did. I mean, I'd seen it before, so I kind of knew what I was getting into, but Lynn perhaps didn't. But tell us about your experience with Stalker.
Well, there's not a issue with Stalker. It's just, like, if you look at the library of films that we typically cover on Please Don't Send Me Out of Space, it's usually the more mild stuff, a lot of 80s, a lot of more recent things like that, the things that people typically know. We do have a random movie that we do at least once a month, and that is, sometimes that'll give us something crazy. But in that particular time, my co-host for High and Low, Spencer, was a listener to our podcast. And we were like, yeah, this guy's really supportive. So we're going to program an entire month just based on his selections. And one of the movies he gave us was Stalker. And, you know, being a film nerd, I already knew about Stalker. I had not watched that movie because Tarkovsky has a reputation as being a thick material, if you will.
Yeah, you don't embark on watching a Tarkovsky film lightly.
Right. Yeah. Like, we could watch Terminator 2 or Stalker. Wait. No.
Yeah. It's not very much shove it in the disk drive. Let's just watch this thing. Yeah. It's more. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Set aside quite a bit of time where you have plenty of concentration.
Full concentration, exactly. Which is not something we have on our podcast, but if you listen, you know, that is one of our most popular downloaded episode, and I can only assume it's because a lot of people use it as maybe a primer if they're going to watch the movie, or if they like have to take a class or something like that. And we don't try to fake intellectuality because we're not intellectuals. So we just, if you listen to that episode, dear Russophiles listener, you're going to hear three confused people. And it's okay. Like, it's not that we didn't enjoy the movie. I think we all appreciate the fact that we saw it, and there are, like, we reference it later, like, oh, this is going for a Stalker feeling, or like, I went to the store the other day and I thought I was in the room. But it's not a movie that any of us are racing to rewatch because it hurt us.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to watch it something like 3 or 4 times before I actually made it all the way through, just because I would stupidly put it on like last thing at night and just go, okay, I'm gonna watch it, and then it would just be like, nope, everything is just saying go to sleep, turn this off. Yeah,
absolutely. It's not like you said, you gotta put a pot of coffee boiling, you gotta have your your notepad out and be ready to pause it. It's the movie's already, how long is that movie?
I think it's about 2.5 hours.
So it's already a pretty hefty movie, but if you're really going to get into it, you're going to make it a 4-hour experience, because you're going to have to, you might have to parse it out in your brain.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. So, like, I wish I had been able to see it when it had a release recently here in the States on some big screens, but I didn't get a chance to go down to L.A. or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Seeing a Tarkovsky film on a big screen is definitely one of the things on the bucket list. Yeah, very much so. But from moving from one really famous cinematic name to another, as you mentioned, one of your two podcasts is High and Low, which is the Kurosawa podcast. So tell us a little bit more about the format to that one.
So I should explain that. Go back my explanation about what I'm all about. The whole reason I chose to do podcasts is because I wanted to force people to watch movies with me.
That works.
And also force them to have discussions with me. That's the kind of situation I'm in. So with High and Low, we watch a Kurosawa movie, and then we watch another Japanese. We watch another Japanese movie from that same year, and we do kind of a compare and contrast to see what the feeling around the country was. Sometimes it's a more popular title than the Kurosawa. Sometimes that's absolutely impossible. You know, when we watch one of the big Kurosawa movies, we end up watching like a gangster film in exchange or whatever. And it's sometimes a very highlighting fact to see like how Kurosawa was staying within this very singular, like, prestige, almost. Like, I don't know if it was on purpose or these were the things that they were assigning him. And then you see something like I don't know, we've watched a whole bunch of Edo era Japanese gangster movies that are full of like people's limbs getting cut off and stuff like that. It's like, what did people want in the country at the time? What was the feeling? And we've really recently just kind of dwelled into some of the feelings of Kurosawa has some propaganda films, so we've dwelled into that kind of stuff. And our most recent episode was on his first post-war movie, and it feels like a mirror reflection of the one we had watched just before that, where it's like he's highlighting the leftist side that was against the war and against Japan.
That he sort of was having to keep quiet just so he could, you know, get on and do his job before then, yeah.
Yeah, and it's hard to, like, we can't speak to him. We can't really talk to an expert on it because we don't have those kind of connections. And in this case, the movie was No Regrets for My Youth, or for Our Youth. And it's packaged together with a bunch of his post-war movies on the Criterion box set. So it doesn't come with those bonus extra features with the, you know, talking heads talking about, oh, it was influenced like this and all this stuff like that. And, you know, it doesn't have any commentary tracks or stuff like that. I'm sure I can find an essay or two about it. But I feel like I don't really get a feeling for what Kurosawa's actual feelings about the war situation were, because Spencer brought up during The Most Beautiful, Kurosawa considered that to be his most personal film. But
yeah,
that movie is just 100% propaganda, and it's not very interesting because of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember when I watched Battleship Potemkin for another podcast, Classic Schmasic, and the propaganda element was just like, okay, yeah, I get it. And it is a bit of a turnoff when you know what it's trying to persuade you and you're not buying it for a second. But yeah, that is really interesting that's, I guess he didn't say it was his favorite of his own films, but the fact that it was the one with the most of himself, or yeah, he said it was the most personal. That is interesting.
Yeah, and I mean, the main actress in that movie was his wife, so I can't help but think that that had something to do with it too, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely going to make him less impartial on the subject of that movie, definitely, yeah, in sort of in retrospect. Yeah, I mean, as far as Kurosawa is concerned, it's sort of interesting to me that, well, I didn't realize how prolific he'd been until I started listening to your show, but he tends really to be famous for his samurai films in terms of, like, oh yeah, Kurosawa, samurai is what he's known for. But those aren't, at least from what I've picked up, aren't even necessarily his best films, at least as far as you guys are concerned.
They're absolutely wonderful. Every single one of his samurai era films is mind-blowing in scope and in acting and stuff like that. But I think that when it comes down to his filmmaking, it's harder to see his influences, because he was definitely influenced by earlier filmmakers, by Western filmmakers, by, you know, like John Ford and other people before who would come along. But when you see them in the sense of the old samurai movies, you know, like, obviously Yojimbo feels like a Western and it was later copied to be a Western and stuff like that.
Sure.
But things like Seven Samurai, it's a 3-hour epic and it's absolutely gorgeous. So it's harder to parse where he was getting his things. But when you see things that are coming from a more modern Japanese setting, like, well, now I'm drawing a blank. I'm not an expert. I should say this. Hold on.
Well, but let's High and Low, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. High and Low. I mean, we talk about how much that feels like a Hitchcock movie and how much it's definitely film noir. You know, it's got all these modern aspects of Japan with it, only a few peeks into what people think of as, like, back then traditional Japanese living. And that's always when they enter into the poor area, as opposed to the higher upper class thing. That's another thing I'm noticing more recently, is that the more money people seem to have as characters in the movie, the more Western they act, as opposed to the rural villages, right? And it's like High and Low, obviously, hugely critically acclaimed. But if you ask the average movie watcher, like, oh, do you like any Kurosawa movie? They name the samurai films.
Sure. As far as the non-Kurosawa ones that you've watched, are there any sort of hidden gems or, like, favorite ones of those that you kind of discovered as a result of doing them on the podcast?
Well, let me tell you about a little movie called Godzilla that Godzilla, the original Godzilla is actually really good, in case somebody has, for some reason, not watched
it. I have never actually seen it, I'm afraid, which makes me feel sad that I've seen the 1998 one with Matthew Broderick. You know,
you can't, I mean, that's just an effect of the era. When are you going to see the other Godzilla?
Yeah. They're not going to be showing that on, like, a wet lunchtime at school or, like, at the end of term, you know, when I'm still a teenager. No, it's going to be the 1998 one. Although I must say that film is almost redeemed by the presence of Jean Reno, but maybe that's just because I like Jean Reno too much.
Jean Reno can't save that movie. Come on.
Yeah. Okay. No.
that's a movie where they were like, well, the Americans caused this, right? No. Let's blame the French.
Yeah. And they'd been doing
get Jean Reno in here.
Yeah. But, I mean, he's good in it, but then he's good in...
Oh, of course, of course.
Scene. But, yeah. But anyway, we're kind of off on a tangent.
So other things that are non-Kurosawa that really stand out. Like, I've absolutely fallen in love with the more stylized gangster films. The Tokyo Drifter is one of my favorite now. That's a Seijin Suzuki movie. And that's a gangster action musical
Nice.
And it is gorgeous. I'm just dying to see it on the big screen. Recently, I got... don't tell anyone. Recently, I got knowledge that I may be able to get some movies projected. And I was like, oh, I think I need to buy a Blu-ray now.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
But yeah, that's just like so much fun. And Spencer hates it. But I personally fell in love with the style. And most of the time, it's... Kurosawa was very good for the most part, but sometimes there's just like you get blown away by the other things that were going on at the time. There is one called Pigs and Battleships by Imamura.
Oh, I thought you might mention this one. Yeah, because you've kind of come back to this one as a favorite on several episodes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It just kind of blew us away because it's set in the modern time, 1961. Or maybe a little bit before that. Mm. But it's another gangster-ish film, but it really focuses around one young guy who thinks he's going to move up in the world, and he's kind of an a-hole, and his girlfriend is attached to him, and it just deals with all these modern like taboo subjects, I feel like. Like There's a scene where his girlfriend goes and she just goes and gets an abortion. And it's not like, it's not graphic. It's not showing her getting an abortion, but she goes to a clinic and they're and like, okay, we'll take care of it over here. It's just a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't make a big deal about it. It's like in happening in this country, somebody would have been banging a Bible in her face. But there it was just like, no, I have to go get it done. I'll go get it done.
Yeah. And certainly, I guess a 1960 film in Britain or the US, that just, yeah, it wouldn't, I can't imagine it would get made or it would be, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, looking at the films coming out at the same time, like Breakfast at Tiffany's, West Side Story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and Breakfast at Tiffany's, they almost totally sweep under the carpet what she actually does for a living.
Yeah, she's a cat watcher, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, movie. Yeah, yeah. Professional cat sitter. Yeah, very, very lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Muy bueno.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's just reminding me of the Mickey Rooney thing, seeing as we were on the subject of Japanese stuff.
Hey.
Shudder.
I'm sorry I brought that up.
Yeah, no. Yes. Anyway. Yeah, so... oh, no. I've totally lost it now, because I'm just thinking of racist... Mickey Rooney. I mean, it's not his.
So, I mean, if you're looking for Japanese movies, that's great to do. We've also watched a bunch of Ozu stuff, who is considered a master now, but he wasn't until the maybe the last 30 years. And it's such a contrast of Ozu stuff compared to Kurosawa stuff compared to some of the more actiony Japanese stuff, because Ozu's is mostly just these slices of life. And our favorite one is this like comedy drama called Good Morning, which has fart jokes in it, and that's about all you need to know. You should watch it.
Nice. All right, add it to the list. So kind of the reason why I've been talking with you so much about High and Low is because we're actually watching a Japan related film. It focuses on Japan. The film we're watching today is The Sun. And the director of that is Alexander Sokurov. It's from 2005. And it focuses on, I don't know very much about this going in, but the last days of World War II with the Japanese Emperor Hirohito. So that is the connection with that. Have you seen any of this director's other films by any chance?
No. That's interesting. I am actually about 30 minutes into the movie Russian Ark, and it is fantastic.
Okay, like, yeah, because that was the one film that I thought if you've heard of this guy, this is the film of his that you've heard of. I haven't seen it yet, but it's on my list to watch. But I thought, just to be a contrarian, I'll watch this one first and not the famous one. But yeah.
Well, it fits into Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space, because it's kind of a man out of time.
Mm.
And it's all done from this first person view where you can hear the protagonist's thoughts. At least that's as far as I know it is. And it's just gorgeous. This is another movie I'd love to see projected. But it's also confusing because you don't really know what the thread is, if there's going to be a story, what's going on. So, like I said, I'm 30 minutes in. I got to finish it up.
Yeah, I mean, that one's kind of famous for, as I say, I haven't seen it, and it sounds a bit like a gimmick, but essentially it's one take. And they, you know, they used like post-production to remove stuff from the frame digitally that wasn't supposed to be there. But I think they had like three goes at it. And it's like an hour and a half, and it doesn't cut away. And you kind of think, wow, just as a achievement to orchestrate that, you know.
Yeah.
Just thinking, doing this podcast and, you know, getting like 5 minutes in and then saying something stupid and going, oh no. you can cut around that, but just the whole point is we're not cutting. And if someone just, I mean, obviously they did take stuff out, but you know, if somebody makes a serious mistake, it's like, you know, 40 minutes in, it's like, right, back to the start.
Right. If a part of the set falls in or something like that.
Oh no. Right. Whoever's job it is to secure that, you are now fired.
Or executed, whatever we can afford.
Yeah. Maybe in Stalin's Russia, but anyway, yeah, so that's the film that we're watching today, and I'm glad to hear that's shaping up to be a good one so far. The Russian arc, that is. So we'll definitely get back to that one. All right, I think we should probably wrap things up for the time being then. So what we do at this point, I always make my guests speak a little bit of Russian. It's one word, and that word is поехали.
Поехали.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Oh, I've done it again. I always sound so patronizing. But yeah, it's got that "h" sound in. That's a bit tricky. But so what that is it's what Yuri Gagarin said as he was becoming the first man in space, as he was blasting off, because it means something more or less like "off we go" or "we're off." So So yeah. So. You could use it on...
I would have assumed it was a curse word, but you cleared that up.
Yeah, no, I'm not making you use Russian profanities against your without your knowledge. Don't worry. All right. So, 3, 2, 1.
Поехали!
We've just watched The Sun, directed by Alexander Sokurov from 2005. And before we discuss the movie, Joel's going to give us a quick summary of it. So over to you, Joel.
Certainly. The movie is about the last days in Japan before they surrender over to the American government. Here we follow Hirohito in his incredibly boring day-to-day life, being, you know, stuck inside this house. It's not even really, I mean, I guess it's a mansion based on the size, but because of the closed quarter nature of where he's allowed to go for safety reasons and who he's allowed to interact with, it feels tiny.
Yeah, almost like a kind of military bunker. Some of the sort of corridors and stairwells have much more of that kind of a feel.
Yeah. When he goes, you know, he does at one point go underground and into through some tunnels to be able to speak to the people who are handling the active military side, you know, and everyone is presenting a positive, you know, a semi-positive summary of, what's going on to this, the God Emperor, because everyone still thinks, or thought back in that day, apparently, that the emperor was descended from gods. And eventually the American army shows up. They, you know, it's they are completely terribly obnoxious. They set up a meeting between is that MacArthur?
Yeah.
Between General MacArthur and Hirohito. And it's, I mean, that's basically what it is. It just all leads up to when Hirohito actually surrenders to MacArthur, signing the paper and such. It's a very slow, like, chamber piece, if that's the term.
Yeah, it's an odd movie. It's quite in some ways it's, you feel like it'd be better suited to TV rather than, like, I can't imagine going to the cinema and seeing this almost.
Yeah, that is exactly what I was thinking. I once watched this 6-hour History of the Medicis, which I believe was an Antonioni TV movie production. And it reminded me a lot of this because it was a lot of people talking to each other about, like, and this agreement was made between these people and you know, very soft music. There wasn't much music going on in this movie, if any. I don't really remember. But it has a very, like, I don't know what to say, low budget, I guess.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I don't know whether this was just my copy, and I watched it on a legit DVD, but it seemed really quite grainy.
Yeah.
I guess it was made, well, I know it was made about 13 years ago, so it's not like technology back then was that bad. So I feel like, was that a stylistic choice, or... I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they might have gone for that Dogma 95 natural light kind of thing. I mean, I could almost see that being the case with the, you know, when Hirohito is just shuffling around his offices with the two manservants who are taking care of him. But it just has a very, I mean, that goes along, I think it's purposeful. I think it just goes along with the whole dour feeling, you know, the boredom, the absolute boredom of Hirohito's life at this point, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's fair to say it's not an interesting movie. I think we've kind of already established we both feel that way. But would you say it's a well-put-together film?
It is in some respects. I'm not sure, like, I don't really know what the historical, like, actual events of this situation was, you know, even though I co-host a Japanese movie podcast, I really haven't looked into history other than when it occurs with a movie we've watched. So I don't know what Hirohito's situation was. I don't know what the American side was, how that all that stuff worked out. But it feels true to life. Like, I can say that because in situations where you feel like something big is going to happen, like, in context of your own life, you can think of events that have happened, and they may seem mundane, but if you, in a context of, like, the bigger picture, it might be a very important event or something like that. You know, I could see that being the case, especially with... In this case, somebody who's being so heavily protected that he's being, like, literally shielded from the news and everything like that.
Yeah, like, there's one little sequence where the Americans are driving him to this first meeting with MacArthur, and you just get to him looking out of the window of the car and seeing all this sort of devastation, and he doesn't say anything, but you can see it's visibly, like, shocked him. At least that's what I got out of that.
Yeah, because there's nothing like that in his, like, immediate environment. Even when he goes outside of the location where he's being kept, it's still like somebody's taking care of the lawns and the trees. Everything looks, you know, as perfect as they can make it look out there.
Well, and down to the fact that somebody literally dresses him, like, very early on. You know, he's changing clothes, and his really old manservant is doing up the buttons on his shirt, or at least, you know, trying to, with eventual success, I guess you'd say. But that's just incredibly hard to relate to.
Yeah. He's not. Go ahead.
He's not one of us.
He is used to a particular lifestyle, although he doesn't seem particularly happy about it either. I mean, even in the beginning, he's talking about, like, how I'm just a human, just like everybody. And then he sees how visibly upset it's making his manservants, and he's like, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, it was just a joke. Ha ha, ha ha. You know, all those great, I'm not really divine material. It's a classic every time. Mm. Or something. Yeah.
And they I mean, even with that, like, him being this descended from gods thing, they treat him like a child, in the sense that he's scheduled for nap time.
Yeah. There's a bit where they literally go, Your Highness, this is what you're going to be doing today.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, okay.
Yeah.
Which is...
Well, there was a point where he says, like, well, can't we do this? And he's like... And the guy just repeats the schedule. No, blah, 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 from this time. Like, he doesn't say no. He just says, you know, 1600 this, 1700 that, whatever.
Yeah. And then I can't remember who it is, whether it's Hirohito or whether it's somebody else says, but yeah, of course, if the Americans show up, then the schedule's out the window.
Right.
Speaking of which, you mentioned earlier on that you thought the Americans were kind of obnoxious. Could you develop that a bit?
I mean, I don't know. What do you think? You don't think they're too bad? Is that what you're saying? You want to hang out with these guys?
No. I got that feeling too. So it's quite reassuring that an actual American thought that too.
We act like the Americans are always, like, you know, very disrespectful. We're always trying to, you know, pushing people around, taking pictures, no, I don't. That's not the case. Like, these are supposed to be rambunctious American soldiers that are like, we won, so what do we have to? We don't have to respect any of this stuff like that. And
yeah,
it comes off as just frankly disgusting. Like the way these guys are acting around it. And the manservants, you know, and the caretakers that are on this facility taking care of the emperor are, you know, they are grossed out by this, and they cannot believe their shock on this. Hirohito is actually handling it like, okay, whatever. You know,
yeah, he kind of rolls with the punches surprisingly well for somebody who is not used to people not being on their best behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, he's not. I mean, maybe he didn't understand necessarily what was going on. Like, these Americans are yelling, hey, Charlie, do this, Charlie, that, you know, referring to Charlie Chan.
Oh, is that what that was? That makes sense now. Ugh, that's, oh, man. Yeah, no, that went over my head. That's gross.
Yeah, it's incredibly gross and probably absolutely true.
Mm.
What'd you think of the guy who played MacArthur?
He was interesting. I'd never seen that actor before. So that was, I mean, I'd never seen any of this cast before. So that always helps you kind of, when it's a historical thing, buy in a bit more than when it's someone super famous. It's like, Brad Pitt is, I don't know, JFK. Yeah. I mean, like, random example. And it's like, no, it's Brad Pitt. I thought, yeah, he was interesting. And in terms of the obnoxiousness, I think his character conducted himself, I found, was almost more got to me than how the soldiers did, because to an extent it's kind of like these really young guys who've kind of never been anywhere in their life, and there's a certain amount of, like, crowd mentality and egging each other on going on. So it's kind of like, not to excuse it, but it's kind of like, okay, well, that's sort of understandable that they might not behave as you'd like, but you've got this really important, you know, experienced, proper grown-up, and he's just being this really smug, patronizing, yeah. But yeah. In terms of the performance, if the director was going for, this guy is supposed to rub you up the wrong way, he really did it, because he's just, yeah.
Yeah, he does. He really rubs me, like, the actor rubbed me as somebody who'd done a lot of local theater. I don't know. I didn't
really buy the sort of gravitas that should have gone with at least the American version of MacArthur. And I think that's like perfect. I think that is for showing how kind of like human everyone was and how awkward and upsetting things would have been at that point. Like, I think this is kind of perfect in that sense, because just look at the, I just looked up this actor Robert Dawson, who played MacArthur.
Yeah,
and his movie credits are the Coco Chanel TV movie that was made that had Shirley MacLaine in it. The this movie, obviously, The Sun, and a movie called Class of Nukem High 2, Subhumanoid Meltdown.
Yeah, I think I was scrolling through, because I hadn't seen him, so I'd looked at the IMDb thing too, and it is like, yeah, it's a weird bunch, so it's kind of clearly the director's going for, well, I'm going to get somebody who's not a big star.
they probably tried out a couple of people, and I mean, the guy's an actor, I'm not saying that, but
sure,
it is like watching it as an American, knowing the way World War II, like the figureheads of those are held up in this crazy esteem, it was off-putting, and it was appropriate in my opinion.
Yeah, it wasn't having it as being this kind of grand figure of stature, or however you'd put it. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe that's something you get by having a non-American director. I mean, it's too simplistic to say that the movie takes a dim view of the American side because it's directed by a Russian. And of course, you know, Russians famously get on well with Americans. But you wonder whether there's a certain element of that going on. I mean, certainly I was surprised how sympathetic I felt towards the Emperor, actually, from the way it was portrayed. Like, there was this, speaking of MacArthur being a jerk, like, one of the big examples is they're talking about these plates, and he said, well, they came from this German baron, and apparently he used to meet with your best friend all the time, and the Emperor's like, huh? What do you mean?
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, Hitler. And obviously not quite in that tone of voice, but it is kind of
basically.
Like, yeah, it's just like, you're a grown-up. You know that that's not how top-level geopolitics works, necessarily. So, yeah, it just seems like a bit of a, well, you're not really in a position you can argue, so I'm just going to say anything to you.
I mean, they must have figured they were having their own fireside chats, right? It's Hirohito, Mussolini, and Hitler all getting together.
Yeah. And
their own version.
Yeah, and Hirohito's really offended, because I think he knows that Hitler is not a nice man that you want to be associated with.
It doesn't seem like he's offended. It seems like he's, I mean, he's very matter-of-fact with all of these handlings. Like, he understands the situation. So he's just like, I have never met, what does he call him, something, whatever his title is, Hitler.
Yeah.
Like, obviously. And then he explains they joined because that was, like, based on what they knew, it was the winning side.
Yeah.
And yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair to MacArthur, I mean, the war in the Pacific was really nasty, and a whole load of Americans died in the process, so
absolutely.
And, you know, Pearl Harbor, the Japanese started it, so you kind of, yeah, you would understand why he wouldn't necessarily be super courteous towards the guy, but it is just kind of like, wow, that's not very mature. So if that's really the way it went, and I have no idea how historical it is, it's kind of like, you'd kind of expect better from somebody at that level, but
yeah,
maybe I'm being super naive.
Well, it seemed, the first time they met, it seemed like he had very little respect for him. This, it seemed like the second time that they met together, there was more of a we understand what's going on situation, you know, we're sharing a meal conversation type thing. Like, it's still, he was still being
disrespectful in the sense that obviously he must have been angry about the whole thing. But I think at that point, he, just after their first meeting, he probably had realized this Hirohito is not this like mastermind who was purposely going out to destroy America. You know, he is responsible in the sense that he's the leader of the country, but he's not an America and a hating, you know, monster or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, it portrays him very sympathetically and or at least I thought so. I mean, in terms of the actor who plays Hirohito, Issei Ogata.
Yeah.
What did you think of him?
I thought he did fine. I just don't. Once again, I don't know much about the historical figure. You know, this.
Yeah.
Did Hirohito have this lip, you know, spasm thing that he was doing the whole time?
Yeah, that, I'm so glad you brought that up because I was like, that was really weird. That really, that was one of the things I most noticed about his performance. Actually, was this kind of weird, like tick. It's almost like he's pursing his lips and they kind of flap a bit before he speaks, like he's gonna say something and then he's not, and then he's gonna say it again, and it's super odd.
Yeah, what was the thing that he was super into? His like personal hobby was a marine life.
Yeah, marine biology. Like, we have this whole scene where he's in a lab and he takes out this crab, and yeah. And he mentions that it has that its shell means that some people call it like a. Say it looks like a samurai head because it looks like this, like, mask that they used to wear. And then it goes on. Yeah, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, he's into marine life. He's kind of doing that mouth thing, which I kind of feel like fish do, right? If you look at goldfish in the chamber, they're just kind of moving their mouth. Like, I don't think it's necessarily what's going on. I'm sure Hirohito must have had this particular tick. Yeah. And that's why they did that. And it comes off as so obvious because this is... I mean, this is they could have called this Hirohito instead of the son, because it's like all about him and it's intimate to him. You know, we're close up on his face so many times while he's saying these things.
Yeah, I almost read that as being like some kind of like manifestation of the stress just really, really getting to him.
Yeah, that could be too.
Because, I mean, how bad would that be to not only you're the leader of your country and you've just... had your behind handed to you spectacularly in a war, but also they think you're divine. So it's kind of like, I don't know. it's just very weird to get your head around. And he's really just, you know, this regular guy who'd far rather just be in his lab and looking at crabs and stuff.
Yeah.
Although in that scene brought up something I was totally unaware of, because he kind of has this musing going on where he's looking at this crab and he's saying, oh yes, you find these off in other parts of the world, but the kind that you find in Japan, they don't stray very far from the shore, and migration and immigration and emigration. And then that gets him thinking about this law that California passed in 1924, I think it was, banning any more Japanese people coming to the state, which I had no idea about. So in that regard, it was quite educational for me and quite shocking.
Yeah, I didn't know about that specific law, but I had learned recently that the U.S. was involved in the war that Japan was fighting in China, like Russia and the U.S. apparently came to the aid in that case against Japan. So there's like old feelings that I had no idea. I didn't know the U.S. had touched Japan until World War II. And then a propaganda movie called Army by Kinoshita, I believe, went through a couple of generations of characters, and they were talking about the U.S. warships, you know, attacking the army and stuff like that. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. This is like the 1920s. Course, it turns out it was just something that I had no idea about, which is par for the course with American history.
That was one of the things watching this movie, was just thinking, I do not know anything really other than very broad brushstrokes about this part of World War II. It's kind of like, because for us in the UK, we did have lots of troops over in the Far East, and lots of people got captured when the Japanese invaded what's now Myanmar, and a lot of our POWs were treated really, really badly. And the explanation I've always heard for that was that the Japanese at that point didn't think it was honorable to surrender. So if you'd surrendered to them, they were kind of entitled to treat you as horribly as they felt like. So yeah, we kind of know it from that angle. And other than that, it's just World War II, in terms of popular history here, is just so much Nazis, 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 Nazis. It's, yeah. So we don't really get that picture. And because Hitler is such a huge figure, Hirohito is like, oh yeah, and the Japanese were involved too.
Yeah, Japan as a whole.
yeah. And yeah, sort of Japan as a whole. And yeah, we've kind of heard of Hirohito because he was sort of the leader. But because he's not this, you know, weird, horrific monster figure that Hitler is, it's kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, you don't think of it that way because, yeah, Hitler, huge amount of atrocities. You think of Mussolini did, you know, terrible things, was a crazy dictator. I don't think of Hirohito as doing that, but, like, Japan did terrible things.
Totally.
But nobody's like, oh, it was Hirohito who did it.
Yeah, and at least the way this movie portrays it, it seems like he was the figurehead and he had some say in it, but he wasn't kind of like, and then we should go and do this kind of thing. It was more like people were saying, Your Majesty, we should go off and do this. And he would be like, yeah, okay. I mean, that's...
I wasn't doing anything anyways.
Yeah. Can I just go back to my biology lab now, please? Yeah, it was kind of like that. And writing really depressing poetry, which is the other thing we see him do at one point.
Yep.
Yeah, so like in terms of how the movie was directed, were there any things that you liked? Sorry, it's a total non sequitur, but never mind.
No, it's fine. I mean, there's not much to talk about plot-wise, so...
No.
Pick out the things. And like that also goes for direction-wise. Like, having not seen any of this, the other person's movies, and from what I understand, this is part of a trilogy, right?
Yeah. There's one on Lenin, and then there's one on Hitler. So, yeah. It was kind of interesting. This movie got me thinking slightly of Downfall, in the sense that it's, you know, that very last period before it's the end for that.
Right.
Power in the war, but it's so different because it's removed from that. It's not at the center of Berlin and the roof's falling in. It's kind of removed, and Hirohito, you know, is clearly very stressed and very upset with how things are going, but he seems like a relatively decent guy as opposed to, you know, Hitler.
Yeah, I can't really say anything about the directing. It didn't stand out as either good or bad. I'm not sure. Like, I'm not even sure about I can comment on the cinematography. It was mostly held still, you know, from room to room.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it doesn't stand out either.
Sure. Yeah. One thing I was going to say I noticed, but I watched the beginning of it the first time round with my wife until she got bored and opted out. And she pointed out that, at least in the bit that I was watching with her, it's all on a slant, like at the beginning, like just the angle of the camera, it's just slightly wonky. And it's like that in every single shot for, I guess, the early part of the movie until the Americans show up, and it's so consistent. And I thought this is definitely, they have decided that they are doing that. This is not just someone was slightly sloppy that day. And
right.
I guess that's supposed to, I'm assuming that's meant to convey that all is not well. But I mean, sometimes it was so slanted that it almost looked like, you know, like it was a ship and it was tilting and people were going to be sliding to one side of the deck.
Right.
I just moved my hand across the screen as if this is on video, but but you know what I mean? It's yeah. So that was kind of the only thing that particularly stood out to me. And then there was one other thing, which was the weird fish bombing dream slash, well, he's just woken up, but he's taking his nap and then he wakes up and he's sitting up in bed, and then you have this weird sort of fiery vision of a city being bombed from the air, it seems, and it's just, it's kind of hard to make out, but there's these big fires, but instead of like regular bombers, it's these kind of weird fish in the shape of bombers, if that makes any sense. And they're, some of them are kind of swooping, and then some of them are falling like they're bombs coming out of a plane, and it's super weird. But that's the only kind of like standout thing besides, you know, in all of it, really.
That's basically his life at that point. You know, all he thinks about is the bombings, the destroying of his country, and his precious marine life.
Yeah.
I don't think that anything, like you said, was done spur of the moment. I feel like this director probably had storyboarded out everything that he wanted shot in a particular way, done in a particular way. It doesn't feel accidental. It feels kind of like a stage play in that, like, I can feel like there's blocking, like you start over here and then you go to this seat and you move to another seat. Like those scenes in the office with MacArthur and Hirohito, there's a lot of them like shifting position, offering things, moving, looking at stuff. It's not like somebody's just wandering around the room. It feels like there was tape on the ground and you're like, now you're at this spot kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, there's one, speaking of offering things, there's one bit where MacArthur's offering Hirohito a cigar, and initially Hirohito turns it down and then says, actually, I would like it, and it won't light. And so you have MacArthur saying, just light it off mine, and they kind of lean in and their faces are really close to each other. And
right.
I don't know why I'm particularly bringing it up, but it was kind of like a...
No, it's a weird moment.
Yeah, just because normally you wouldn't have two military enemies up that close in a sort of diplomatic negotiation. So that's quite a weird... Yeah, as you say, it's an odd moment.
It's like he wanted to stare his enemy directly in the eye or something like that, and so he took this opportunity.
Yeah, you could totally read it like that. Yeah, I can see that.
But it has this weird intimacy,
because
of that, and it's an uncomfortable part. And I feel like that must be done on purpose.
Yeah,
like because it's an uncomfortable situation.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. You were saying something, and then I interrupted you. Which is my want, sorry.
No, I don't remember anyways.
there were a few things which I was kind of like, is this meant to be funny or is this just, I don't know, my weird way of interpreting things? But there's a bit where he's got all these statues on his desk of various different people. It's quite eclectic. But he has Napoleon on there and he looks at Napoleon and is like, and then he hides it in a desk drawer. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's probably a pretty good idea. You don't want the Americans to see you with this Napoleon statue because they might interpret you as having some kind of delusions of grandeur.
Some sort of complex, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, just desire to conquer everyone in a, you know, hubristic, disastrous way. Yeah.
Sure.
So I thought that was kind of funny. And then the other thing that was very weird was the possibly poisoned chocolate.
Yep. I mean, that's, isn't it? Famously, they sent chocolates to Winston Churchill that had bombs in them. So, I mean, it's not that crazy an idea.
Sorry, who sent Winston Churchill bomb chocolate?
I'm not sure which person did, but during World War II, apparently one of the things that one of the enemies tried to do was send chocolates that had explosives in them to Winston Churchill. I'm not sure how close they got or whatever, but And it could be hearsay. It could be completely fake, but that's one of the stories I've heard.
Clearly, they had just not done their research properly, because if you're trying to get Churchill, it would need to be some kind of strong alcohol. That would be the way to do it.
He looks like a man who might enjoy some chocolate. Come on.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. Not all of that blubber could be from just the booze. Although you never know. He was pretty spectacular.
Oh, no. He had a very sharp mind.
Yeah, yeah. All things could, well, just anyway, but considering the...
Yeah. I like the guy's reaction to that when Hirohito, is handing out the bars to everybody, which is funny because when they leave, everyone hands the bar back anyways, but yeah. He makes the one guy actually try it, and you can tell that the guy almost likes it, but he immediately has to go, oh, I much prefer rice candies. This is,
It's really brilliantly acted, because you just see this like moment of pleasure, and it's like, ooh, chocolate, because he won't have tasted that for a while.
Yeah, wouldn't have had anything like that, probably.
No, and it's just like a split second, and then as you say, he's kind of like, liking chocolate, especially American chocolate, it's not patriotic, so yes, rice sweets, much better. None of this American muck. it's kind of like, is that product placement? Because if it is, it's the frickin' weirdest product placement I have ever seen in a movie, so...
I don't think it is product placement, man. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just that sometimes the way it's held up, it's slightly like that bit in whichever one of the Wayne's Worlds it is, that it's just very level and, like, face-on with the camera, so you can definitely see what the brand is.
It's that's another insult, probably. Like, oh, send this boy man chocolate. He'll like that.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know. Or maybe it's just kind of like, well, all their industries are going to be destroyed after the war, so hey, let's get them hooked on this stuff.
You know what they're going to like? Chocolate, because everyone likes it, right? Right? No, not necessarily.
But anyway, that was weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the moments that stands out in all... Like I said, everything feels awkward, and I think on purpose. That's just one of the many scenes where it's like, what is going on here? Like, who thought this was a good idea? Why is it being conducted like this? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It is bizarre, but as you say, it's very deliberately so. So, you said you hadn't seen other films by this guy, but I thought you mentioned that you'd seen Russian Ark.
Oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that. I haven't seen the entirety of Russian Ark. I've seen about the first 45 minutes of it. And okay. You want to talk about polar opposites. That movie is nothing but movement. It's nothing about flowing. There's obviously hundreds of extras in it because it's all taking place. I'm not sure... where it's supposed to be, but it's all done from a first person view, so the character is walking or being guided constantly through these different environments. And yeah, I'm like, these are both quote unquote art movies in the sense that I don't think a general audience would be crazy about them.
Yeah, it's not like Transformers 3 or meant to pack out the multiplexes.
No, well, Transformers 3 is an art movie also. No, I'm just kidding.
yes, sorry, besmirching Michael Bay's reputation, I take it back. I think that was shot in the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, which is literally where the Tsars used to live until the Russians decided that was not a thing they wanted to have anymore.
I see. Yeah.
Yes, so, and it's now basically a massive...
That's when all those Russian czars got to retire, right?
Yes, to the farm upstate.
Yeah, that's nice.
I can't believe I'm joking about a whole family being murdered in a horrible...
Sorry,
way.
I bring that out in people.
Yes, never mind. But yeah, it's now like a massive, massive art gallery. I actually went there for... a few hours when I was in St. Petersburg like 7 years ago, and it's just like, it's one of those, you could probably go there every day for a week and for a couple of hours and see quite a bit of it, but still not get round at all.
Yeah.
So, all right. So I kind of feel like we've covered this movie in a fair amount of depth. Is it a dumb question, given the content of our discussion, to ask you whether you'd recommend it to people?
I mean, you're going to have to tell me what you mean by dumb. Like, do you already think you know?
I think I know you're going to say you're probably not, but...
Yeah, that's correct. I wouldn't say that this is a rush on see it.
Yeah.
I can't even, like, compare, because it's a well-done movie. I wouldn't say it's a good movie. It's an interesting movie. But it feels like homework. Like, there are movies that I watch on purpose because of my ongoing film education, where I feel a sense of boredom, not actual boredom. Like, I'm not distracted looking for something else to do, but I feel like the material is a little thick and is a little purposeful in what a director is trying to go for. And that feels like, you know, the vegetables for my brain, for my film watching thing. Like, I would compare it to Stalker, except for Stalker is a much, much, much more interesting movie than this was.
I was going to say, like, where does it compare with, because I think we mentioned this in the intro, so apologies if we didn't, I'll just cut that bit out. yes, or like, where does it go on the Stalker scale of weird / not deliberately entertaining movie. So yeah, that's interesting to get that view.
There's a certain purposeful mediocrity to this movie that Stalker does not have. Stalker is purposely obtuse.
Yeah.
This I feel like is purposely boring to show that historical, you know, context, that life that Hirohito was living.
Yeah, that being Hirohito at the end of World War II really kind of sucked.
Yeah.
You know, whether that was his fault or not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the end, we didn't mention at the very end, he finally gets reunited. Does he get reunited with his kid or just his wife?
We just see his wife, and his kids are meant to be out in the corridor, but we just see them go out into the corridor. We don't actually see the kids.
Right. And there's a level of reserved excitement that the actor is showing, because he finally, after who knows how long, is reunited with these people, that at that point it feels like this kind of like sweet, like earned feeling.
Yeah, yeah, I thought it was quite touching. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it almost makes the movie worth watching, just because it's like you're following through on the story, and at the end it is a pretty nice reward that you feel like everything paid off in this weird way.
Yeah.
Because it's not a happy story. Absolutely not.
No. And there's also a bit of a knife in the guts at the end as well, because Hirohito turns to his chamberlain and said, so what happened to the guy that young man who recorded my speech? And the guy goes, yeah, he killed himself. And I'm like, oh, right.
As you do.
Presumably, because the implication being that this was such a dishonorable thing to be a part of that the guy just couldn't handle it.
Yep.
I was like, oh, man. And, yeah, and Hirohito says, did you try and stop him?
I'm like, no. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Why would I do that?
Because it's a person and suicide is horrible.
Yeah.
No one says that, but... Yeah, it's a really sad film, and whilst it's not an enjoyable film, and I, like you, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it unless somebody specifically asked me for, you know, like you said, please recommend to me a film that feels like homework. They're like, okay, I have a movie for you. But it did... It's going too far to say I feel like I understand the Japanese experience in World War II. It's like, no, that's ridiculous. But I feel like I have a little bit more insight into it than I did going in. And it made me want to investigate that a bit more, so that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, there's, I mean, there's so many great movies that deal with the World War II itself and then the direct aftermath of World War II. You could give somebody 100 movies just to watch on their own. I do feel like if somebody's studying up and this is their way that they're looking at things, if they're watching films to learn about World War II or just studying World War II films in general, I do think this might be an essential one because it is completely different than what I'm used to when it comes to war movies.
Yeah, it's a war movie with no combat, war. Basically. Yeah, you see some GIs, and you see a couple of bombed out buildings, and then there's this surreal imagined bomb sequence with weird fish. But yeah, other than that, that's it. That's it for your actual war, which is, yeah, as you say, is not something you're used to seeing.
Yeah.
So maybe you should go and watch it after all.
It's for very specific people.
Yes, yes, with very specific movies that they want to watch. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Joel, for discussing that odd movie with me.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate getting to watch a movie that I'm unfamiliar with in any context, but I always appreciate a good discussion.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's been, the discussion has been more interesting than the, much more interesting, I should say, than the actual experience of watching the film. But it made me feel like, I feel like if I just watched that film and not talked about it with anybody, I'd feel like that was kind of a waste of time. But
right,
yeah.
Yeah, you might forget about it if you don't have somebody to talk about it with.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, before you go, though, is there anything you'd like to direct listeners towards?
Well, sure. Talking about film discussions, I have my own podcast. I have two podcasts, technically, but I consider one to be more the other person's podcast. And like people ask me, oh, why did you pick that kind of podcast? It's like, well, because I wanted to force people to watch movies and then talk to me about them. That's the whole reason. Like I could watch 100 movies a month, you know, if I really wanted to, but it's not very much fun if you don't have somebody to talk to about it.
Yeah.
And so I've got a science fiction and fantasy podcast that I do with my co-hosts, Sarah and Aaron, called Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space. And we watch science fiction, as I said, science fiction and fantasy movies. Right now we're going through the Next Generation Star Trek movies.
With Patrick Stewart. Not that that's how he talks, but that's best theatrical
voice. That's
pretty
good. That's pretty good. That's better than any of us could do.
Yeah, I have a slightly unfair inbuilt advantage there.
Yeah. I appreciate it anyways. And we talk about a whole range of different stuff that's available on the usual places for podcasts. And the other one I do is
What was the title? Did you mention
the title? Did I mention the title? It's called Joel's Podcast of Sci-Fi. No, I'm just kidding. It's called Please Don't Send Me into Outer Space.
Awesome.
That'd be good if I just totally forgot. And then I do a Japanese movie podcast called High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast with Spencer Seams, where we are going through Akira Kurosawa's entire library and pairing it up with another movie from each year that the films came out. Most recently, we released the episode on Redbeard, which was Kurosawa's last film with Toshirô Mifune. Took them 2 years to make, and I'm pretty sure it's a masterpiece. It's not up there with his most famous samurai movies, because I think those have more of a wide appeal.
Sure.
But there are things done in Redbeard that I have not seen Kurosawa do. And that just that alone has blown me away. There's a whole bunch of episodes, High and Low is what that one's called.
Yes. Yeah, that's always good when you've seen enough stuff by a director that you notice the patterns and therefore notice when the patterns are broken.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Yeah, we've had some real movie expert guests on there too recently, and they're just kind of blowing me away with information. So that's another good thing. Like, these people wouldn't give me the time of day if we didn't have this podcast.
Oh, I'm sure that's not true.
No, that's probably not. And Alistair, you were on an episode. Which one was it?
I was. It was the Lower Depths one. Yeah. With the Russian connection being that it was an adaptation of a Maxim Gorky play. So going into the slums of, I guess, early 20th century or late 19th century Japan and generally being quite miserable. But you do have Toshiro Mifune being very cool in it. So that's always worth a watch. So yep. Yes, check that out as well. And your co-host Spencer was on an earlier episode of this podcast. So shameless plug there. It was the episode on Tsar about Ivan the Terrible. So you can go and check that one out if you haven't already.
You guys Russia nerded out. I heard that.
Yes, it was very, very nerdy. So I'm guessing that's okay. If you're listening to this podcast, you must have at least a passing interest in Russia. So
absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks again, Joel. This has been really fun.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that's all for today. До свидания.
До свидания.
Or perhaps sayonara in this case.
Sayonara.
Hello again. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rooster Files Unite podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. So, there's a couple of different ways you can do that. There's a Rooster Files Unite Facebook group you can join. We're on Twitter, at Rooster Files U. That's Rooster Files with the letter U at the end. We're on Instagram, at Rooster Files _Unite. And you can also email at roosterfilesunite@gmail.com. Also, if you can spare a couple of minutes to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, that will help other people hear about the show and would be very much appreciated. Thanks again for listening, and goodbye.